I'm Marie Bernard, host of Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Join me Mondays at noon as we explore the universal energy that connects us all. Let's discuss our journey of self-discovery, joy, presence, and living with authenticity. We can create positive change in the world, and it starts within each one of us. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Mondays at noon on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver. Hello and happy new year. Welcome to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Thanks for being with me today. And I say this every week. I'm really excited about today's guest, but I am. I read some of his articles on psychology today and I just had to get in touch with him. So today we're speaking with Dr. Guy Winch. He is a licensed psychologist, keynote and TEDx speaker and author whose books have been translated into 15 languages. Today we're going to be talking about his book, Emotional First Aid, Healing Rejection, Guilt, Failure, and Other Everyday Hurts. He's also the author of The Squeaky Wheel, Complaining the Right Way to Get Results, Improve Your Relationships, and Enhance Your Self-Esteem. So welcome to the show, Guy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being with us today. So I've read your book, and I have to say, the more I work on myself, the more I have to work on myself. It's getting a little frustrating. Your book is, tell us about who this book is for, please.
Really, I wrote the book for everyone. I wrote the book because it struck me that when somebody gets a cut or a cold or a sprain in a muscle, they know exactly what to do, how to evaluate how serious it is. They have a medicine cabinet of ointments and pills and different things that they can use to feel better. And we sustain psychological and emotional injuries in life just as often, if not more often, than we do physical ones. You know, injuries like when we experience failure or rejection or the pain of loneliness or guilt. And yet when those things happen, we don't have a clue about what to do. We don't have a medicine cabinet. We're not even aware we're injured. We don't evaluate how we're doing and in what way it might be impacting our lives and our thinking and our behavior. So it struck me that we really need that kind of medicine cabinet for psychological injuries, and that there was really sufficient science at this point to be able to compose one. And that's what I wrote the book to serve as.
Awesome. So it seems like the best way to use this book is to read it cover to cover and then keep it around in your psychological medicine cabinet for reference.
Absolutely.
Okay. And we'll talk about, so some of the topics that you cover are rejection, loneliness, loss, guilt, rumination, failure, and low self-esteem. And I really like how the book is laid out. And one of the things that, one of the really valuable things is that you talk about what that is. Like, we'll talk about rumination as an example. And then you talk about what it does to us if we keep doing it. And then you break down how to deal with that, how to do the emotional first aid. And then in the final part of every chapter, you talk about what signs might let you know that you need more help and need to see a professional.
Absolutely. Because, you know, it struck me that, you know, we're very educated in terms of our physical beings at this point. In other words, you don't need to explain to most people that if you don't, you know, take care of a cut, it can become infected, or what an infection even is. But when it comes to the psychology of things and how our brain works, we actually don't know very, very basic things. And by we, I mean, you know, most people. So psychologists who've, like me, who've went to university for many, many years and gotten advanced degrees might, but most people don't. And so it was important for me to be able to define what it is we're talking about, how it manifests, what it looks like, what it feels like. And I try to bring in a lot of stories from my private practice and from life to kind of really illustrate the ways in which these seemingly small things can play out in sometimes very big ways.
All right. Well, I wanted to talk about the book kind of in order, but last night I was finishing up the book and rumination is near the end. But I'm realizing, reading your book, that I know I'm a ruminator, but I think I ruminate more than I realized. And because of what you pointed out of the impacts of rumination, now I'm ruminating about how much I ruminate. So can we
go over
that? Yes, but
at least you should know what to be able to do to stop doing that.
Well, maybe you can give us some tips on how to deal with rumination, and maybe even people who are listening might not even know exactly what that means.
Well, rumination is like brooding. What it really means is that when something upsetting happens, you know, your boss yells at you in a meeting, or you have a big fight with a friend, or with a significant other or family member, and you just keep replaying that scene in your head over and over again. And what I say when I talk about rumination is that there's, you know, reflecting on our experiences is a natural thing, it's a good thing, but there are two kinds of self-reflection. There's a adaptive kind in which we're really trying to reflect in order to better understand, in order to gain lessons from it, to decide on action, to see things from a different perspective. We're really problem-solving when we're doing all of those things. And that's an adaptive form of self-reflection, if you will. And if you're doing that, all is well. But we sometimes get stuck. And when we get stuck, all we're really doing is replaying the scene over and over again in a loop. We keep just replaying that scene of our boss yelling at us and how embarrassing it was or how upsetting it was. Or we'll keep replaying the breakup talk that we had. And we're just going back to it over and over and over again. And when we're stuck in this way and we're just replaying things, it's actually not an innocent thing. It turns out it's a very harmful thing, because when we use adaptive self-reflection, when we're trying to problem solve, there's a big emotional release that comes after that. When we figured out that the boss yelled at us in a meeting because we actually contradicted the boss a sentence or two earlier, and that annoyed the boss, and so lesson learned, don't contradict the boss in public, then the boss won't embarrass you in public. Once we figure that out and had that aha moment, then we can kind of let it go. But when we're just replaying, we're not letting anything go. We're just stirring ourselves up over and over again. And the research tells us that by doing that, we're actually getting almost as upset, if not as upset and sometimes more upset, than we were when the original incident occurred. So we're really, you know, I call that chapter picking at emotional scabs, because that's what we're doing. We're really not letting an emotional injury heal. We're making it worse, we're keeping it bleeding, and we're flooding our body with stress hormones each time we replay that scene, and it can become very addictive, so that it just keeps popping into our minds and we indulge it. So therefore, this kind of brooding, this kind of rumination is not an innocent thing, albeit it's a very, very common thing, but it's really something we need to attend to as a very unhealthy, psychologically speaking, habit.
And so it sounds like, just with all of the issues that you cover in your book, the key is, if possible, to catch it as early as you can before it really starts to start building neural pathways in your brain and all of that.
Absolutely. You know, I had, coincidentally, I had a friend that I met yesterday, and she was telling me that she had to run to the doctor because she had this pain in her toe, and it became so bad, and it swelled up so badly that she realized something was very wrong. And I said, what was there? She goes, well, it was a cut, but I didn't realize it was getting that bad. And like, but you didn't realize that there was an infection kind of happening, and that you have to, like, treat these things quickly. And most people do realize. Most people, if they have a cut and it starts to hurt, won't just let it go until their foot swells up, you know. And so it's the same thing with psychological injuries. The earlier we catch them, the better we can address them. And not only that, the more we address them, the more emotional resilience we can build as a result, because we'll feel more confident and more able to deal with these kinds of situations when they arise again, and they will arise all the time.
Thank you. Well, it's interesting. I actually wanted to ask you, speaking of rumination, what is the difference between rumination and worry, or are they the same?
Ruminating usually refers to events in the past. You're usually ruminating about things that happened, and worry usually refers to worrying about things that have yet to happen. So that's the distinction, is you're looking back in rumination, you're looking forward in worry.
Thank you for that, Dr. Winch. And I'm curious also, you mentioned rumination is typically like you go over one event in your mind. Now, the way that I tend to ruminate it makes it, you provided a wonderful exercise on visualization and changing your perspective of the situation. But for me, what I tend to do is it won't just be one event. As an example, in a relationship, I'll go through and add up everything that creeped me out or everything that got my back up, and I'll put, so it could be 6 months of events or 5 years of events that I'll have in my mind. Did you have any tips for someone who does that kind of ruminating?
Yes, I think it's fair to kind of ask yourself, when you find yourself really doing that kind of deep exploration, and obviously you're not sitting and doing that in 5 hours straight, but over time, but it's fair to ask yourself, well, what am I really, what's the question I'm really asking here? What am I really trying to figure out? In other words, if you can identify what you're really trying to figure out, then it can help you. Now, say you're trying to figure out, should I stay in this relationship? Or does this relationship make me happy? Even by framing your thinking in that way, I'm trying to figure out if I should stay in this relationship, it will send your thinking in a different direction than just allowing your mind to freely wander into all the upsetting incidents that happened without really framing that as, should I really stay in this relationship? Or do I really need to address this issue? By putting a headline on what you're trying to do or a goal that you're trying to achieve, by doing all this thinking, it will actually send your mind in a more productive path, down a more productive path than if you just let your mind wander idly.
Thank you. That's very helpful. And I noticed you said the goal, okay, should I stay in this relationship? And for me, I would be thinking the opposite. I need to figure out if I need to leave this relationship.
Kind of the same question to my mind. In other words, should I stay or should I leave is the issue. But, you know, does the relationship make me happy? And I think with relationships, since we're on that topic, I think they're always, because a lot of my practice is couples therapy. And what I say to couples a lot of the time is, look, there are two questions here. Number one, what's the best I can make this relationship? What can I do to process with the other person the things that aren't working to try and make them better? What's the best I can make it? And then I can evaluate whether it's good enough. But if you've been in it for a while, it's worth trying to figure out, can I improve the things that need improvement? Can I get my partner to work with me to make better the things that need improvement, or to communicate better, to really try and see what's the best we can make it? And then you're in a much better position to evaluate whether it's workable for you or not.
Thank you so much for that. Well, right now we are speaking with Guy Winch. He has a PhD in clinical psychology from NYU, and we're speaking about his book, Emotional First Aid, Healing Rejection, Guilt, Failure, and Other Everyday Hurts. And we'll be back with more Synchronicity in just a moment.
Are you not sure where to go on campus? Traveling late at night and afraid to go alone? Call SafeWalk, a free service where a co-ed team will take you anywhere you need to go on campus. Don't walk alone. For a walk, add SafeWalk to your phone. Call 604-822-5355. That's 604-822-5355. Alternatively, use a UBC Blue phone and ask for SafeWalk. Approach any SafeWalk team or drop by our office on the main floor of the sub across from the gallery lounge. Because you're mine, I walk the
line. If you'd like more information about today's guest, you can go to his website, guywinch.com, GUYWINCH.com. And you recently did a TEDx talk. It's up on your website. Can you tell us what that was about?
Yes, the TEDx talk was called How to Practice Emotional Hygiene. And really that was about, I spoke on that talk. I made the talk kind of personal, and I used examples from my own life, and primarily about my relationship with my brother. I have an identical twin, and I used examples from that relationship to illustrate some of the, some of the psychological wounds I sustained myself in life, and how, at certain points I was blind to them, and how I really needed to focus on improving my own emotional hygiene. You know, that I say in the talk, 100 years ago, we started practicing personal hygiene. We started washing our hands and doing very, very simple things. And it had a remarkable result. Life expectancy rose by 50% in just a matter of decades. And I think we're at the same place right now with emotional or psychological hygiene, except it won't be life expectancy that can rise. It will be our quality of life, because there are so many ways in which we have these habits, like rumination that we just discussed, which actually make us feel worse and distress us and upset us and impact our quality of life. And there are so many ways in which we could actually make things better and make ourselves happier and more fulfilled, except we're unaware of them. We don't know we need to, quote-unquote, wash our hands, psychologically speaking. But if more people knew about it, if more people started practicing it, then I think that there could be a real significant change worldwide in people's happiness, in their mental health, in how we treat one another, in all kinds of ways. So I think we're at that threshold, the same way we were 100 years ago with personal hygiene and learning about, you know, hand washing and certain things that can keep us healthy. I think we're at the threshold in terms of our psychology and our minds, and it would be great to cross that threshold.
Mm, absolutely. And I mean, you say that it would only be our quality of life, but I think our life expectancy would increase too, because all throughout the book, you talk about not only the impacts on our relationships and our happiness, but the physiological impact of ruminating, loneliness, all of those things.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a very interesting thing that I found when I was doing research for the book. Time and time again, I found that things like rumination, things like loneliness, things like self-esteem have a really direct and immediate impact on our physical well-being. You know, and just to speak about loneliness as an example, when people start to feel lonely, it immediately suppresses the functioning of their immune system. Immediately. And there was one study done on college freshmen. When they came in, the health services gave them flu shots and gave them a questionnaire, you know, and asked them as part of the questionnaire, do you feel lonely? And they found that students who reported feeling lonely, and these are incoming freshmen, they just left home, so likely they would, but students who felt lonely had a significantly worse reaction to the flu shots. Their immune system didn't handle it as well because their immune system was suppressed, and they had just been at college a number of days or weeks. It was very, very early on. And so there are certain things, you know, we know, rumination, for example, because people who habitually ruminate are constantly flooding their systems with stress hormones, because when you start thinking about upsetting things, you know, and by the way, let me just say, this is an interesting difference between our physical and our psychological sense. If you ever broke a limb, and let's say you broke a leg, and you think back to the time you broke your leg, one thing I guarantee will not happen is your leg will not start to hurt from the memory. But if you think back to a time that somebody broke your heart, you will start to feel hurt and rejected. And so psychologically, we can evoke so much of our past wounds just by thinking, you know, about them. And when we do that, we are creating stress in our systems, and we're flooding our system with cortisol, the stress hormone. And so people that say you have a tendency to ruminate and do that habitually are at significantly higher risk for developing cardiovascular disease because of that tendency than people who don't have a tendency to ruminate. So yes, there's a huge link between the psychological and the physical, and improving our psychological will not just improve our quality of life, as you said, it will actually improve our health and longevity.
Thank you for that, Dr. Winch. And it's interesting because you talk about how loneliness is contagious.
Yes, there was an interesting study done, and actually there are a lot of studies done about loneliness because, you know, it's one of those ignored, forgotten, marginalized things. You know, we all know about it. We all know people who felt that way, and many of us have felt that way. I think 40-50% of us will feel that in our lifetime in certain moments. And in that TEDx talk, I spoke about when I was a time where I was feeling extremely lonely and how it impacted me. But one of the things, so it's one of the research projects was done on a social network of people. And what they did is they tracked people over 6 months, and they tracked the lonely people, and they looked at how significant and connected they were within their social networks. And they found that over time, not only the stigmatism of loneliness pushed lonely people to the margins of their social networks, it actually also pushed the people who were immediately around them further toward the margins, as if there was something contagious, as if the stigma was contagious. And so there are various ways you can understand, you know, why that happened. Loneliness is a stigma. We do tend to stigmatize that kind of thing. I can tell you in my private practice, people will admit to all kinds of things. They're not that comfortable admitting that they're lonely. It's just something that we tend to feel, you know, oh boy, that'll make me a real loser if I say that, but it's something that we really do experience in a pretty frequent way. So yes, loneliness and, you know, and for that matter, you know, there are other studies that show even depression and the kind of thinking that goes with it. Those kinds of things can be contagious, a certain kind of negative mindset that is common for people who are feeling lonely and, for that matter, for people who are feeling depressed, is something we can adopt when we're around people who are very negative, who see the world in very negative ways, who are constantly looking at how bad things are and how things will never work out. And, you know, it can impact us that we start to see things in that way, even if it's not our tendency. So there are all kinds of impacts of these things, some of them on us and some of them on those around us that we do have to pay attention to.
That's interesting. I do notice that my outlook on a lot of things, relationships, anything, changes when I'm around someone who's really calm, centered, and has high self-esteem versus someone who has a very pessimistic worldview. I actually notice that it impacts my own worldview.
It absolutely does. And it's one of those things, and I absolutely am not suggesting we defriend or reject friends who happen to be pessimistic or depressed or lonely by any means, but we would be wise to try and balance out the roster a little bit. In other words, if you don't have people in your life who tend to be, as you said, optimistic and have a positive worldview and wake up with a smile, as it were, I would seek out a couple of those people and befriend them, even if it kind of goes a little bit against your grain, because you probably need a few people like that in your life. It's a perspective that's probably really, really valuable, because if we just, misery loves company, so if we're just going to surround ourselves by other miserable people, we're going to be really impacted by that and become even more miserable ourselves, which is probably not our goal. And B, when we surround ourselves or when we have in our lives people who are very upbeat and optimistic, it really is a little bit like a ray of sunshine, which we can all use, in certain doses. And so I'm actually for paying a little bit of attention to who we people our lives with, who we surround ourselves with, and do we need a kind of to shake up a little bit and add some positive people to that mix.
I'm curious if, now, some people, because they're lonely, and you talk about how loneliness kind of is a self-perpetuating thing, for people who have trouble making deeper connections, are there ways to get more social interaction with positive people at more of a surface level, or like, say, watching a comedy show or something like that?
I think... Look, you can watch a comedy show and that'll improve your mood, you know, for the short time. But in fact, there's research about people who are lonely, and they were given the option of watching a comedy show or to elevate their mood and watching something else that wouldn't elevate their mood, and they chose the thing that wouldn't elevate their mood. Part of what happens to us when we're lonely is we feel really, really shut in, and, you know, psychologically speaking, we feel really like we dig in and we kind of, retreat. And so we're actually very hesitant to peek our heads out and to take on, you know, positive people or positive experiences. It feels very dangerous for us to do that, because it's as if you feel like you're constantly on guard for being under attack, not physically but psychologically, for being rejected or for being insulted. And so, you know, just putting yourselves in those situations feels very fundamentally dangerous. And that's why people, once we start to feel lonely, our tendency is to avoid those things as much as possible, because our mind is telling us, incorrectly, mind you, but our mind is telling us, oh, that's not going to end well. Yes, you know, you might have gotten invited to a party, but your mind is going to tell you, I'm just going to go, I'm not going to know anyone, no one's going to want to speak to me, it'll end up making me feel worse, so why go? Or if you do force yourself to go, you will then go and stand in the corner with a scowl that's so uninviting that indeed no one will then speak to you, which will confirm your fear that you're undesirable. So it's really with loneliness the biggest challenge I think people face. And again, if people watch that talk that I gave, they'll see I face this myself, and so I'm well aware of the challenge. But the biggest challenge people face is to really disregard what your mind is telling you, because our mind is not always accurate. It's often inaccurate. It's often actually giving us a very erroneous message. And so we actually have to disregard that. We have to really try and go with an optimistic mindset. You know, I mean, I say to people, parties, this is not middle school. So if you're at a party somebody invited you to, no one's going to be blatantly rude to you there because somebody invited you. These are all people who know the host. And so if you just walk up to a group and say, oh, how do you do? My name is so-and-so. People will give you the time of day, you know. And so you have to be a little bit more optimistic, a little bit more hopeful, and have a little bit more positive mindset. And then one thing will beget the other. You know, once you start doing that, then you'll start having successes, then you'll meet one person, and your whole outlook can change if you take it on as a real task to try and emerge from that state.
Thank you. And if you want to see the TEDx talk on how to practice emotional hygiene, you can go to Dr. Winch's site, guywinch.com. Now, Guy, throughout the book, throughout all of these issues that we deal with on a fairly frequent basis on one level or another, one extreme to another, you mention, I can't remember exactly what you called it, but how we have this perception of the world and we're often unable to see beyond the beliefs that we have. Like with the example with loneliness, oh, we think nobody likes us, when really it's the things that we're doing that are making it almost impossible for people to approach us.
Yeah, I think I called it something like a self-defeating prophecy or something like that. In other words, we develop certain perceptions as a response to these kinds of emotional wounds that we sustain. When something bad happens to us, then it impacts not only how we feel in the moment, but it literally impacts how we perceive the world on the most basic level. I'll give you just a very clear example, and that is it was relating to failure. They did one study where they took a group of people to an unmarked field that had American football goalpost, and they had people kick a football several times to try and kick it over the goalpost. And then they had them estimate once they were done, well, how far away do you think that goalpost is, and how high up do you think it is? And the people who succeeded at the task, the people who failed at the task estimated the goalpost as being much further away and much higher up than the people who succeeded. Now, they were all standing on the same field looking at the same thing. This is not a vision issue. Their eyesight was okay. It's just that the failure distorted their literal visual perception so that they thought something was further away. And it was a symbolic study to me because when we fail, it indeed distorts our perceptions of our goals and makes us believe they are further away and further out of reach than they actually are. And then, because we believe that, then we begin behaving accordingly, and we might develop all kinds of fear of failure or anxiety about success, or we might give up entirely. And again, one experience of failure can actually do that to us. I'm not saying that's always the case, but it is true that, you know, for example, we spoke about college freshmen. If a college freshman, you know, comes to college and he gets his first midterm and fails it, oftentimes they conclude, I'm not cut out for college. College is too difficult. Now, really what they should be thinking is, well, this is more difficult than high school. I need to change my study habits, my strategies for how I'm approaching school, because it's, you know, college is a notch more difficult than high school in a way. But a lot of times they drop out. There's huge attrition rates in freshman year because people get despondent and they perceive something that they've looked forward to for 4 years as something that's now impossible, when that's not true. That hasn't actually changed. They just need to change a strategy, but their perceptions are telling them, oh, this is not going to work. And then they start acting accordingly and really self-sabotaging, but they're not aware that it's their perceptions that really kind of did that to them. So and again, this is part of why I wrote the book. We need to know that, you know. We need to know that our perceptions are off. If I may, just one other quick example back to loneliness for a minute. When you have the flu and you're in bed for 10 days and you get up for the first time or to go to the bathroom and your legs wobble, it's very clear to you that your muscles became weaker because you were in bed for 10 days. When you've been lonely for a while, and let's say you haven't been dating, and then you go on a date and it goes badly, you don't conclude, as you should, I'm a little rusty with my dating skills, I need to practice this for a bit. You conclude, I'm undesirable. But it's the same thing. Our social relationship muscles are like physical muscles. They need to be worked out. We need to practice them. We need to hone them. If you haven't been on a job interview in 10 years and you go on one, you're probably going to mess it up because you're just not used to thinking that way. And so we have to start thinking of a psychology as and our abilities as something that we can hone, that we can strengthen, that we can change, rather than just that they're speaking the truth about our situation in general, because that's not the case.
Mm. And the fact that even one failure can distort our whole perception of either the situation or our whole worldview is just more evidence as to why everyone needs this book, because you've got to nip it in the bud.
You have to nip it in the bud. Again, one of the things I say that people have the hardest time with is that you can't always believe what your mind is telling you. Now, I don't mean for people to walk around never knowing when to believe what their inner gut feelings are telling them. But there are certain situations, and I lay them out in the book, in which you actually should not believe what your mind is telling you. And failure is one of them. They did these famous experiments quite a few decades ago, but they were about a phenomenon called learned helplessness. And they gave people task that seemed simple, and half the people got the task as it was, and half the people got the task in a way that made it impossible to complete, although it seemed simple on the surface of it. And so they did that with two groups of people, and then they gave them the same task in a different version that was possible to complete for both groups. And the people who were unable to complete this simple task the first time around, because it was actually impossible to complete, also failed at it the second time around, even though it was very possible to complete. It was absolutely within their abilities. But that first round had convinced them that they were incapable of succeeding, and they believed it. And once they believed they were incapable of succeeding, when that task came around again, even though they were perfectly capable of doing it, they actually failed at it just because they believed they couldn't. And that's what failure does to us. It convinces us that we're incapable of things we're actually capable of. It throws us off the scent. It makes us focus on the wrong thing rather than focusing on what do I need to do differently? What do I need to change? What do I need to tweak? We're focused on self-consciously on I'm a loser, I'm unable, why do things never work for me? And that actually doesn't help you figure anything out. It just makes you miserable and then more likely to fail in the future. So it's really important that we understand how these things impact our minds and our thinking and know when to disregard this urgent message from our gut. Or like in rumination, sometimes the urge to ruminate and to just replay that scene once more for the thousandth time feels very urgent and very important. And it does feel very urgent. It does feel very important. That's still wrong. You still shouldn't do it because you've thought about it a thousand times already. You're just stressing yourself out and making yourself miserable. So knowing when to disregard these gut feelings, these messages from our mind is an important piece, I think, of knowing how to get the most out of our brains and get the most out of our abilities.
And I mean, I guess it's just sort of a learning process, because what I've noticed, I went through, it wasn't really a relationship, it was just a few dates, but it ended because I felt like he was doing things that were manipulative. And the more I thought about it, I do, looking back, I still feel like these were red flags. But the more I thought about it, the more upset I got, the more I was convinced that this person was like maliciously trying to manipulate me. And I realized, I was writing in my journal after, that this is something that's happened in the end of other relationships, where when I start to see things failing and I have this gut feeling that something's wrong, I start picking up more and more evidence. And it's not necessarily that it's inaccurate, but I blow it to such a huge degree that I end up really stressing myself out.
Yeah, now, but that's an interesting example, because relationships are one of those things that a lot of what happens is pretty straightforward, and some of it is kind of ambiguous. And so one of the things that are ambiguous is people's motivations. And a lot of the times it can look like somebody's doing this thing that they should know upsets us, but they're actually not aware that it upsets us, or they're not aware that they're doing it. So, you know, without knowing the details of that, my general suggestions in these kinds of situations is, listen to the initial, look, something was happening that you don't like. There's no question there, right? So it's not a question that something was happening that you didn't like. The question is what to do with it. And if you just start looking for it, then you will find it. Because, you know, when we buy a new red car of a certain make, we'll suddenly notice all the other red cars of that make on the road when we hadn't noticed them earlier, because we're now sensitized to noticing those things. And when you start to think that, oh, this person is doing this, then you'll start, A, noticing when they do, and perhaps overinterpreting when they're not necessarily doing it. So the best thing to do in those situations is, if something is bothering you and then it's happening again, bring it up. Because to me, about relationships, one of the things that you need to do in a relationship is test out pretty early on, can this person work with you? Is this someone who's going to be able to work with you to address issues when they come up? And they will come up. They will come up early. They will come up at some point. You know, there are no relationships that don't take work. So is this person open to feedback? Are they open to working on things? Are they opening to hearing what I'm saying without getting defensive or accusatory or stonewalling or you know, bringing up beefs of their own before they respond to mine? That is a very important question, and I think these are opportunities then to say, look, there's something that's been bothering me, I'm not sure you're aware, and see what they do with it. And then if they can't handle it, if they don't do well with it, perhaps it is a problem. But they might surprise you and go, oh, you know, I was totally unaware. I was doing that for entirely different reasons. And then they don't do it again. Or it could be that they'll say, okay, I get it, still do it again. And when you point it out the second time, they'll get actually better at it. So I think these are opportunities to test out the theory and to test it out with the other person rather than just by yourself. Because by yourself, you're not really giving them a chance to address it. And maybe they cannot. Maybe they can.
Well, it's interesting. There's a chapter on guilt in your book, Emotional First Aid, and it brings up to mind, because I did address it with this person, and the first time, my goal was to understand, and the conversation went really well, and I felt like, wow, this is someone who can calmly have a discussion. I was really impressed. And then I was noticing it happening again. And I went into, this is just like that other guy who turned out to be crazy. And rather than handling it the way I did the first time, I handled it from that perspective. And needless to say, he was a little bit defensive, not overly so, but it kind of further perpetuated the problem. And I'm left now wondering, was all of this behavior him, or was he being triggered by the way I brought this up?
Had the way you brought it up the second time, you mean? Because
yeah.
The first time seemed to have gone well.
Exactly. So how you, I mean, it's important to bring it up and address it, but it's also just the same as with apologizing. How you do it is really important. How you address a topic is going to impact the person who's on the receiving end of that.
Absolutely. I think how you bring it up is the most important thing, because you need to bring it up in a way that's easy for the other person to hear. Because, look, it's natural for us to get defensive when somebody lobs a complaint at us in a relationship. It just is a very natural... We are being not attacked per se, but kind of. We're being accused of something. So even if it's mild, it's natural for us to get defensive, and therefore it's actually kind of important to bring it up in a way that triggers least of these defenses. And I'm certain you did that well the first time, because the conversation went well. What I'm curious about, though, is that when you bring it up again and it doesn't necessarily go well, some people, they will get defensive, but then after that, their behavior will change in a good way. In other words, they might not be able to admit it, but they'll change their behavior, and maybe that's good enough. And some people are just so unaware, or are just see things from such a skewed perspective, that even though they might be able to see what you're talking about, they actually can't change what they're doing. And again, you know, the time will tell in these kinds of scenarios after the second conversation. If things didn't change, then I do think that a beginning of a relationship of a few dates, you're bringing something up twice and things aren't changing, probably not a good sign.
Okay, that's helpful. Because I've been, it ended like a week ago, and I've been thinking about it, and I still feel like I wasn't wrong to have those concerns. And at the same time, because I got emotional and I didn't I saw the way that I dealt with it the first time and how effective that was. And I know that I didn't handle it as well the next time. So because I ruminate and I have all this guilt, it just is, it's kind of, I need to really work on some of the tips in your book.
So actually, let me just say that then, so one of the learning things for you then would be, okay, when I bring something up the first time, I can probably do that well. I have to be very cautious when I bring it up the second time because I'm probably going to be much more upset at that point and much more of a skeptic, so it might not come out as productively as I can actually make it because I did that well the first time. So pay attention to when you have round two in these kind of scenarios because round two is a vulnerable round for you. And I'm just saying it because I think once we figure out what our typical blind spots are or where we typically go wrong, we're going to repeat that error, you know, again and again unless we figure out to pay special attention to that kind of thing. And for you, it might be round two of bringing up something after round one. And so once you know I have to pay special attention on round two, take a very, very deep breath because I'll be more annoyed, but I actually have to do it in the same productive way I did it the first time, that might be helpful in the future.
Thank you. That's really helpful, Guy. I really appreciate it. Well, right now we are speaking with Dr. Guy Winch. He is a clinical psychologist with his PhD in clinical psychology from NYU, and he is the author of the book we're talking about right now, which is Emotional First Aid, Healing Rejection, Guilt, Failure, and Other Everyday Hurts. And if you want to check out his website or his TEDx talk on how to practice emotional hygiene, you can visit guywinch.com.
On News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective. News 101 is Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced student and community newscast, bringing you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective. Tune in Mondays and Fridays at 5 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Live streaming and podcasts are available online at citr.ca.
Welcome back to the show. This is Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. You can find me at spiritualshow.com. You can also find me on YouTube at youtube.com/spiritualshow. And right now, we're speaking with Dr. Guy Winch. You can find him at guywinch.com. And he's the author of Emotional First Aid, Healing Rejection, Guilt, Failure, and Other Everyday Hurts. And we have just about 15 minutes here on CITR before Parts Unknown is up. So I'm just wondering where you'd like to take the conversation.
So one of the things actually I want to mention is I start the book with rejection because I think it's the most common wound we sustain. And I just wanted to say a few things about that because I found the research there to be really, really fascinating. And I think it's just something that we all experience. I mean, you know, in the dating world, we experience it. And when we're looking for jobs, we experience it. When we're looking for internships, we experience it. And, you know, today, unfortunately, on social media, we experience it all the time. And people actually, I don't know when it was exactly, but some years ago, I started noticing that more and more of my patients would bring up experiences of rejection related to social media. They would actually be really upset because they just came back from their vacation and they posted their pictures, and while they had liked all their friends' vacation pictures, now their friends weren't liking theirs, or they were looking for jobs and they were trying to connect with people on LinkedIn and people weren't responding, and they were like, don't they understand it's really important for me because I'm looking to a job, or they were retweeting everyone's tweets but people weren't retweeting theirs. And so social media is this new frontier, I think, for kinds of rejection experiences. Now, one of the things that fascinated me most when I was doing the research about rejection, is what happens in our brains when we get rejected. And people did a study. I'm going to describe the study just because to me it's kind of interesting to see the lengths researchers and other people will go to. But what they did is they recruited subjects who had just had a very difficult heartbreak, breakup, and their heart was broken. And they asked them to come in with pictures of the person who broke their heart and to lie in a functional MRI machine. Functional MRI machines are machines that actually can look at what's happening in your brain in real time while you think about something specific, do a math problem, etc. So they can see what areas of your brain get activated when you're doing or thinking about certain things. And so they asked them to lie in the fMRI machine while gazing at the picture of the person who broke their heart and reliving or the actual breakup conversation. And then they wanted to see, well, what's happening in their brains. So first of all, I think that's kind of brutal. And when I was reading that study, the first section I skipped to was how much do they compensate these poor people to do that, you know, because usually for studies you get $5, $10, they actually gave them a little bit more. But what they found was that the same areas in the brain get activated when we experience rejection as get activated when we experience physical pain. Exactly the same areas. And so that expression, hurt feelings, which is actually the same expression in almost every language, is there because indeed we are hurt. When they saw that the same pathways of the brain respond to rejection as to physical pain, they did another study, and they did a rejection experiment in which they gave half the people Tylenol and half the people a sugar pill, and people didn't know they were receiving Tylenol, which is a pain reliever. And then they put them through this rejection experience, and people who had received the pain reliever reported less emotional pain than the people who didn't. Again, because it's the pain pathways that get activated when we experience rejection. And I found that to be really, really fascinating, because to me it explained why even small, silly rejections can really, really sting. We've all had this experience where people we're not that interested in didn't invite us to a party we wouldn't be that interested in going to, and somehow we felt hurt by it. And you're sitting there thinking, why do I even care? I don't like these people. I'm not interested in their party. Why does it bother me? But it bothers us because literally our brains are wired to experience these kinds of things in a painful, painful way.
And then I'm curious what happens, because it sounds like, I've been through that too, where I'm like something insignificant or an insignificant to me person has rejected me on some level. And I go over it in my mind, like, why am I so bothered by this? And then I judge myself for being bothered because I don't feel like I should be.
Right. Now, that's the thing that I think is most important people to know, that it bothers you not because it actually matters, because this is literally the way our brains have evolved to respond. In other words, part of the assumption of why this is the case, why is it that rejection of all the emotions, why did rejection, literally the expression is that it piggybacks on the pain pathways. Why does rejection piggyback on those pathways? What was the point of that in terms of evolution? And if you think about it, when we were hunter-gatherers living in tribes, then being ostracized, being rejected from the tribe, was basically a death sentence. You couldn't survive alone. You needed your tribe. And so we needed to develop an early warning mechanism to warn us if we were in danger of being ostracized and booted out from the tribe. And that was rejection. And so people who experienced rejection as more painful were more likely to correct their behavior, remain in the tribe, and pass along their genes. And those who did not were more likely to be booted out and not pass along their genes. And then over generations after generations, the more you experience rejection as painful, the more likely you are to survive. Now, imagine times in tribes where there are very few resources. It's a very stressful situation. People can get on each other's nerves. Being super aware of when you might be rejected, when you're getting the cold shoulder, when people aren't being warm to you, would be very, very, very useful. And so that's why that evolved. But now that it has, we're kind of stuck with it. And so then when somebody doesn't like your update or your status update or your tweets, it'll actually hurt whether they matter to us or not. And all that means is you evolved along with everyone else in tribes. It doesn't mean anything about why that person is important or is not important to you. And if you go on this whole exploration of why that person really matters, then you're wasting your time. It's not that that person matters. Your brain is wired that way. And so it's a very important thing to know about rejection, because we can, if we're gauging the pain of things to indicate how much we care, we're getting it slightly wrong, because it's going to be painful in a way whether we care or not. And so it's a very important thing to know. You know, in one experiment, they put people through a rejection, and then they told them that the person who did the rejection was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. And then they asked them, so how does that make you feel? And people still felt emotional pain. And then they told them, actually, they weren't a member of the Ku Klux Klan. It was just a research confederate. This whole thing was a setup. And learning that the rejection wasn't even real did not take away the emotional pain that people were still feeling. They still felt bad because their brains were making them still feel bad, even once they found out it was fake, that they actually never were rejected in the first place. That's the power of rejection and the wiring we have in our brain. And that's why I started the book with it, A, because it's so common, and B, because it has such a big impact on us, and C, because what we then do is something really, really terrible. We then go and beat ourselves up. We become, you know, when we get rejected by a dating prospect, we will start listing all our faults and all our shortcomings and start saying, oh, I wish I was more this, if only I was more that, if only I had more money, if only I were taller, if only I were more blonde, if only I was this, if only... We really go through this litany of all our inadequacies, which actually only makes us feel worse, and in almost every situation has nothing to do with why the person rejected us. They didn't reject us because we're not blonde enough or tall enough or whatever it is. They rejected us because we were not a match for them. In whatever way that manifests, we weren't a good match for them. So, it's not an evaluation of who we are. It's an evaluation of a match, of how our key fit into their lock or vice versa. So with rejection, we experience it. It's very painful. And then we go and we inflict a lot of self-damage by becoming really self-critical and harsh and creating a lot of damage to our self-esteem, making ourselves feel really, really, really bad and adding to the emotional pain that our brains are already providing free. So it's actually really, really important to understand the psychological mechanisms that are in place that we tend to have in a reflexive way when we get rejected, because we need to really take control of those situations and at least make sure we're not making things worse for ourselves by becoming self-critical, at least make sure we're not overthinking things and wondering why something is so painful when it just kind of is, because that's how rejection works. You know, an example of that is it might be a few dates you have with someone, I don't mean you, I mean in general, and people can feel incredibly mournful as if it was an entire relationship. It was only a few dates, but it hurts that way because you got your hopes up and because rejection is wired. Our brains are wired to respond to rejection in those ways. And so I think it's one of those things people, once they're more educated about it and once they're more informed, they can manage those situations in a much healthier way without resorting to the kinds of thinking and the patterns of behavior that are actually unhealthy and damaging.
That was really helpful, Guy. And I'm also curious now, the acetaminophen helps with the pain, but especially in this day and age with social media, we're being rejected on a constant basis. Mm-hmm. We can't just be popping painkillers all the time.
Yeah, I'm actually not suggesting anyone who feels rejected takes acetaminophen.
Okay.
Because it'll take away a little bit, but I don't think that's the solution. You know, the solution is, and this is about social media. I mean, it's happened to me many, many times. I'll see a status update by someone on my phone while I have, you know, something in one hand, I'm rushing in the other, I'm basically flicking, and I just don't have a free thumb to click like. Mm-hmm. But I'll see the pictures, I'll even go, oh, that looks great. And the next time I see them, I might say to them, oh, you had a great time on your vacation. I just don't have the thumbs, the fingers, the time, the wherewithal, whatever it is, to click like. So when we're interpreting a lack of a rejection. We don't need to interpret it in the worst possible way. With LinkedIn, a lot of people, you know, who are looking for jobs use LinkedIn, and people who are not usually don't. So they'll go on there once every few months. They're not adding you to a contact. They just haven't been on there. So rather than assume the worst, on social media, you have no idea what's going on behind the scenes. Why not assume the best? Why not assume that people will notice, and even if they didn't click like, they will actually say something to you, or they will have enjoyed it. And so it's important to put in these corrections, as it were, because our minds can take us to the most negative possible explanation for something, and there's absolutely no good use of trying to think of the worst possible explanation for something. There's actually much better to think of the best possible explanation for something. And when you see the person next, you can say, oh, did you see my vacation pictures? And they might say, oh, you know what, I didn't. I haven't been on Facebook for a while. Or they might say, oh, you know what, I thought I did, but I really was so busy I didn't. I should go look at them. You know, if they're a friend, they care, but they just might not have it might not be important enough, or it might not be critical for them to click like, even though they did like.
But you even point out in your book, when you talk about rumination, how we don't lie awake at night thinking about all the great things that happened in our day.
Yeah, you know, again, evolution here is at fault. In terms of evolution, it was much more valuable to scour the horizon for any kind of threat, because that saved our lives. You know, whether a bear was about to come into the cave we were in was very, very useful. Whether a good thing was about to happen was, in terms of evolution, less of a priority. Nice, but less of a priority. And so we are wired in a way to orient towards threats and negative things. But in our day and age, where very few of us are living in places where a bear might wander in, we need to make an adjustment, a conscious adjustment to our minds, because our minds are operating on assumptions and on situations that we are no longer living in. We are no longer in living in caves. Our survival is no longer, you know, in question every second of the day. And our minds are still operating that way. So we need to institute these corrections and know when to put in a correction and when to adjust for the reality of today's lives, because it'll take many thousands of years for our minds to catch up to where we are. We have to put in the corrections manually, as it were. And a lot of this book is about the kind of manual corrections you can put in and you need to put in these various kinds of situations where your mind is going to lead you astray.
Thank you so much, Dr. Guy Winch, Emotional First Aid, Healing Rejection, Guilt, Failure, and Other Everyday Hurts. We have just a couple minutes left in the show, and I'm wondering if there's anything else that you want to say to our audience.
I would like people to check out the TEDx talk, because I think it's a short talk. It's 17 minutes, but I think it's pretty concise. The other thing is that since I feel we're such on the initial steps of really educating people about how our minds work, the ways in which they help us, the ways in which they don't especially, and what the corrections are that we need to kind of put in, or how we need to really think of things and behave and adjust for things so that we're more psychologically healthy. This is the kind of thing I'd like people to talk about. It's the kind of thing I'd like them to notice in friends, to point out to friends. If you have a friend who is obviously lonely, bring it up with them. Ask them if they're feeling that way. Ask them, you know, maybe suggest that they take a look at the book. Maybe suggest that they look at articles about it. But be aware. I think the awareness to me is the most important thing. Start being much, much more aware of how your psychology works, how your mind works, and how it impacts you, and start paying as much attention to it. You know, I give this example that when we wipe out on a skateboard, the first thing we do is we check ourselves to see if we're injured. That should be our instinct when it comes to psychological injuries as well. When we have a difficult failure or a bad rejection or we're feeling lonely, we need to check in with ourselves and see how we're doing, how we're feeling, if our self-esteem is damaged, if it is, what we can do about it, if our confidence is shot, if it is, what we can do about it, and really not just let things happen, but become much more proactive and much more prominent in the psychological care we administer to ourselves, because there's so much more that we can be doing.
Thank you so much, Dr. Winch. We could probably talk about this all day, but we're out of time. So I really appreciate your time and the work that you do, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Again, that was Dr. Guy Winch. He is the author of Emotional First Aid, Healing Rejection, Guilt, Failure, and Other Everyday Hurts. And again, you can go to his website, guywinch.com, and you can see his TEDx talk. So coming up in just a moment here on CITR, rather, is Parts Unknown. Yeah, it's just all synchronicity all the time. It's all about us. So Chris Arific is coming up with Parts Unknown here on CITR. So Happy New Year again. Be well. I love you so much.
Namaste.
Namaste.
I'm going to be around my vegetables. I'm going to chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub.
It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies.
It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce.
It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems.
Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply.
Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
Are you not sure where to go on campus? Traveling late at night and afraid to go alone? Call SafeWalk,